Angie, I am Nikki Strong, and this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Alice Bryant and John Russell. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Alice Bryant.
Environmental activists and labor unions have worked together in the past, but are now on opposite sides of a heated dispute. The disagreement partly involves the building of an oil pipeline between Canada and the United States. The U.S. is currently the world's largest producer of oil and gas. However, the administration of President Joe Biden aims to bring the country's release of carbon gases to net zero by 2050. One of Biden's first acts was to cancel the permit for the Keystone XL oil pipeline. The administration also said it is reducing the amount of oil and gas production permitted on federal land. The reactions to the administration's moves show the difficulties of forming policy that affects many different groups. Climate activists celebrated the cancellation of the Keystone XL pipeline. But labor unions want to keep projects from being stopped. Mike Nisley is secretary and treasurer of the Ohio State Building and Construction Trades Council. He said he has been asking state officials to talk to the president about the effects of his climate policy on union members. "I tell them they need to get back with Biden and ask if this all really has to happen on day two of the new administration," Nisley said. He said he is unhappy that there's almost no common ground on pipelines with the environmental community. Climate groups have had successes in recent years. They have persuaded large investors to reduce financial holdings in the fossil fuel industry. They also have sought to get banks to avoid financing oil drilling in Arctic areas of the United States. But a number of important labor unions have members who work on pipelines, in oil refineries, and in industries tied to the energy industry. That includes the International Teamsters and North America's Building Trades Unions. Those unions opposed the move to cancel the Keystone XL pipeline. They also are moving against threats to other pipelines. Environmental groups want to block oil imports from Canada's oil sands. They also are intensifying efforts to close three other pipelines. Two pipelines known as Line 3 and Line 5 are operated by the Canadian company Enbridge. The company Energy Transfer's Dakota Access Pipeline, or DAPL, is the other. Unlike the Keystone XL, the three other pipelines are currently operating. The Enbridge lines bring oil and fuel from Canada. The DAPL sends oil from North Dakota to the Midwestern states and Gulf Coast. Legal cases and government rules threaten all three pipelines. A White House spokesman said the Biden administration is considering a recent court decision that called for an environmental study of the DAPL. Philip Wallace is a business representative for Pipeliners Union 798 in the state of Minnesota. Wallace said he was concerned the new administration may try to stop the DAPL. His union is planning demonstrations to support its building once COVID-19 restrictions ease. On Friday, environmental protesters stopped construction on a Line 3 work area in Minnesota. It was one of several actions this year that has resulted in arrests. If KXL can't pass the climate test for Biden, then Line 3 surely cannot, said Winona LaDuc. She is executive director of Honor the Earth, an indigenous environmental group. Unions are also increasing support for Enbridge's Line 5 pipeline. It runs under waters where Lake Huron and Lake Michigan meet. Activists want to close the pipeline, but Enbridge says it is trying to improve it to protect the environment. Enbridge recently received a state permit to build a tunnel for the pipeline. The company still needs permission from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. In November, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer ordered the pipeline closed. However, the United Steelworkers Union has been trying to build support with lawmakers to keep the line operating. In a statement, the group told Reuters that the United Steelworkers Union strongly supports both the Line 5 replacement project and the continued operation of the existing pipeline. The group said hundreds of its union members and their communities need the jobs created by Line 5 to support their families. I'm Alice Bryant.
In a recent report, we explored how the present perfect was playing in a kind of language competition. In today's report, we will continue our journey with the present perfect. But this time, instead of talking about history, we will travel around the world. You will learn how the present perfect has different uses in different kinds of English. Let's begin with a few important terms and ideas. You can think about English verbs in terms of tense, aspect, and mood. Tense means time, present, past, or future. Aspect can suggest whether an action has been completed or not. Mood is complex. Do not worry too much about it today. When we talk about the present perfect, we are talking about tense, the present, and we are talking about aspect, the term perfect. The basic idea is that the present perfect suggests an action has been completed and has a connection to the present point in time in some way. In a recent report, we talked about how Betty Azar, an English grammar expert, defines the present perfect. In her book, Understanding and Using English Grammar, Azar describes the present perfect in terms of form and meaning. The form is have plus past participle. The meaning is that the perfect tenses all give the idea that one thing happens before another time or event. Here is an example.
I have already eaten.
Have eaten suggests that the speaker ate at some point in the past. It also suggests the action of eating has some connection to the present moment in time. For example, perhaps another person asked if the speaker wanted to eat food. This example shows you a general way in which the present perfect is used. But the present perfect has different uses in different kinds of English, as we will see. In recent Everyday Grammar stories, we explored the present perfect in British English. We also explored how Americans have been using the simple past more often than the present perfect. But there is another kind of English that uses the present perfect in an interesting way, Australian English. A study in linguistics looked at the use of the present perfect in a number of Australian radio broadcasts. The lead writer, Marie-Yves Ritz, notes that speakers of Australian English often use the present perfect as a way to make stories seem more real. The researchers call this the narrative use of the present perfect. The examples came from call-in radio shows where people described stories in a natural or everyday way. The basic idea is that the speakers often used the present perfect in place of the simple past. Here is an example from the research, a short part of a radio broadcast on Triple J Radio Sydney. Note that an American voice is reading these words.
I looked over my shoulder. He's standing right behind me. He's walked in, you know, the doors that separate the classrooms. He's come in the one behind me. They all started laughing.
Note that the speaker began in the simple past with the words, I looked over. But then the speaker used short forms of he has walked in, and he has come, the present perfect. The study also gives an example of how speakers of Australian English sometimes change from the simple past to the present perfect after using the word then. Consider this example, once again from Triple J Radio Sydney.
I just wanted to get out of the building as soon as possible. And then, about four of them have come up to me, and one guy's on crutches.
In general, you will not hear this narrative use of the present perfect in American English. Speakers of American English use something else to make past experiences seem more real, the so-called historic present, which you can read about in our previous Everyday Grammar story. The basic idea is that Americans sometimes change from the past to the present when reporting speech or describing a past event. The idea is that the change in verb tense makes the story seem more real and present to the listener or reader. In today's report, you learned about how some speakers of Australian English use the present perfect in an interesting way. You also learned that Americans use a different kind of verb form to tell stories. The next time you are watching films or news broadcasts in English, pay careful attention to the present perfect. Try to watch news broadcasts from different kinds of English, American, Australian, and so on. Over time, you will develop a deep understanding of the present perfect and how different English speakers use it. I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Barbara Klein.
And I'm Steve Ember. The stock market crash of 1929 marked the beginning of the worst economic crisis in American history. Millions of people lost their jobs. Thousands lost their homes. During the next several years, a large part of the richest nation on earth learned what it meant to be poor. Workers lost their jobs as factories closed. Business owners lost their stores and sometimes their homes. Farmers lost their land as they struggled with falling prices and natural disasters. And Americans were not the only ones who suffered.
One of America's greatest writers, John Steinbeck, described the Depression this way. It was a terrible, troubled time. I can't think of any 10 years in history when so much happened in so many directions. Violent change took place. Our country was shaped. Our lives changed. Our government rebuilt. Steinbeck, winner of the 1962 Nobel Prize in Literature, said, "When the market fell, the factories, mines, and steelworks closed, and then no one could buy anything, not even food."
An unemployed auto worker in Detroit, Michigan, described the situation this way. "Before daylight, we were on the way to the Chevrolet factory to look for work. The police were already there, waving us away from the office. They were saying, 'Nothing doing, no jobs, no jobs.' So now we were walking slowly through the falling snow to the employment office for the Dodge Auto Company. A big, well-fed man in a heavy overcoat stood at the door. 'No, no,' he said. 'There was no work.' One Texas farmer lost his farm and moved his family to California to look for work. 'We can't send the children to school,' he said, 'because they have no clothes.'"
Sunday is gloomy. My hours are slumberless. Dearest, the shadow.
The economic crisis began with the stock market crash in October 1929. For the first year,
The economy fell very slowly, but it dropped sharply in 1931 and 1932. And by the end of 1932, the economy collapsed almost completely. During the 3 years following the stock market crash, the value of goods and services produced in America fell by almost half. The wealth of the average American dropped to a level lower than it had been 25 years earlier. All the gains of the 1920s were washed away. Unemployment rose sharply. The number of workers looking for a job jumped from 3% to more than 25% in just 4 years. One of every three or four workers was looking for a job in 1932.
Those employment numbers did not include farmers. The men and women who grew the nation's food suffered terribly during the Great Depression. This was especially true in two states, Oklahoma and Texas. Farmers there were losing money because of falling prices for their crops. Then natural disasters struck. Year after year, little or no rain fell. The ground dried up, and then the wind blew away the earth in huge clouds of dust. All that dust made some of the farmers leave, one Oklahoma farmer remembered later. But my family stayed. We fought to live. Despite all the dust and the wind, we were planting seeds. But we got no crops. We had five crop failures in 5 years.
Falling production, rising unemployment, men begging in the streets. But there was more to the Great Depression. At that time, the federal government did not guarantee the money that people put in banks. When people could not repay loans, banks began to close. In 1929, 659 banks with total holdings of $200 million went out of business. The next year, two times that number failed. And the year after that, almost twice that number of banks went out of business. Millions of people lost all their savings. They had no money left.
The Depression caused serious public health problems. Hospitals across the country were filled with sick people whose main illness was a lack of food. The health department in New York City found that one of every five of the city's children did not get enough food. 99% of the children attending a school in a coal mining area of the country reportedly were underweight. In some places, people died of hunger. The quality of housing also fell. Families were forced to crowd into small houses or apartments to share costs. Many people had no homes at all. They slept on public streets, buses, or trains. One official in Chicago reported in 1931 that several hundred women without homes were sleeping in city parks. In a number of cities, People without homes built their houses from whatever materials they could find. They used empty boxes or pieces of metal to build shelters in open areas.
People called these areas of little temporary houses Hoovervilles. They blamed President Hoover for their situation. So too did the men forced to sleep in public parks at night. They covered themselves with pieces of paper, and they called the paper Hoover blankets. People without money in their pants called their empty pockets Hoover flags. People blamed President Hoover because they thought he was not doing enough to help them. Hoover did take several actions to try to improve the economy, but he resisted proposals for the federal government to provide aid in a major way, and he refused to let the government spend more money than it earned. Hoover told the nation, "Economic depression cannot be cured by legislative action or executive decision." Many conservative Americans agreed with him, but not the millions of Americans who were hungry and tired of looking for a job. They accused Hoover of not caring about common citizens. One congressman from Alabama said, "In the White House, we have a man more interested in the money of the rich than in the stomachs of the poor."
On and on, the Great Depression continued. Of course, some Americans were lucky. They kept their jobs. And they had enough money to enjoy the lower prices of most goods. Many people shared their earnings with friends in need. Years later, John Steinbeck wrote, "It seems odd now to say that we rarely had a job. There just weren't any jobs." But he continued, "Given the sea and the gardens, we did pretty well with a minimum of theft. We didn't have to steal much." Farmers could not sell their crops, he explained, so they gave away all the fruit and vegetables that people could carry home.
Other Americans reacted to the crisis by leading protests against the economic policies of the Hoover administration. In 1932, a large group of former soldiers gathered in Washington to demand help. More than 8,000 of them built the nation's largest Hoovervilles near the White House. Federal troops finally removed them by force and burned their shelters.
"Once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?"
Next week, we will look at how the Great Depression of the 1930s affected other countries.
"Went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with a drum."
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.